It's none of my business, I know, but have you gotten a raise lately? I ask because the Federal Reserve is interested. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday is where we are, everybody. It's the 31st of July. Great, as always, to have you with us. I am just going to come right out and say it. Honestly, if it ain't one thing in this economy, it's another. Not only did we get a GDP report this week that was thoroughly meh, but this morning we got an arguably more important number that was more meh. I guess. It's a thing called the Employment Cost Index, a measure of wages, salaries, benefits, all the stuff that adds up to the cost of employment. The Labor Department says that in the second quarter, that index grew at the slowest pace since they started keeping track of this stuff back in 1982. Why am I telling you all of this? Because higher wages is one of the touchstones that the Fed is looking for as a signal that at long last, the economy is strong enough for them to raise interest rates without pouring cold water on the whole smash. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman starts us off.
Is the job market now basically normal and healthy after the Great Recession? Or is it still wounded, leaving lots of people who want to work and earn a decent living behind? Today's really low increase in pay and benefits is a big piece of evidence for the still wounded side, explains economist Aslam Yeleja at IHS.
It's a big shock because we see employment numbers very solid month to month, and unemployment rate has been declining. We are now close to full employment.
That should make it easier to find jobs and tougher to hire workers if you're an employer. If we did have that kind of recovery going, we'd see employers lowering their requirements for job applicants, says economist Jesse Rothstein at UC Berkeley.
We'd also be looking for evidence that wages are increasing as the employers need to pay more in order to attract people to the jobs. We're really not seeing much evidence of any of those, which suggests that we really are still in a situation with a fair amount of slack in the labor market.
Labor market slack means millions of people hungry for a job or workers so afraid of losing their jobs they'll work without a higher paycheck. Yeleja says this is what worries Fed Chair Janet Yellen.
She's concerned because the measures of the labor market, such as unemployment rate, sometimes they don't measure the slack in the labor market correctly.
Today's report indicates the healthy job market diagnosis might be wrong and the economy might not be ready to take the medicine of higher interest rates yet. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
All right, all of that said, I cannot think of two better people to take apart this past week in the economy than the two that we have lined up. Lynette Lopez is with Business Insider. Felix Salmon is at Fusion. Hello, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hello.
All right, hello. You do that every time. All right, so listen, Lynette, your big bugaboo, it's been like, what, a year, year and a half now, has been wages. And here we are, wages came up and bopped us right on the head. All right, what do we do with this?
I have no idea. Listen, I'm not Janet Yellen. It's above my pay grade. But what I do know is that 0.6 is a sad little number. And if we're going to continue with the idea that we're going to raise rates before the year is out, well, hopefully we're going to see some growth. What Janet Yellen has always been is rational.
Yep.
And
data-dependent,
she's always
right? Yeah.
Followed data dependent and always followed along. So I don't think she's scared to backtrack and say, actually, no, 2015 is not the year. So let's just keep watching the numbers. And if they don't improve, then maybe we will have 2016 rates.
Felix, you know, all right, go ahead, and then I'll ask you a question.
You know what else is a sad little number,
what?
Okay?
What?
Is 0 to 0.25, which is where the Fed funds rate is
right
now. And it's even lower.
Felix made an interest rate joke.
The fact is that this is the thing which I think people are losing sight of. We have this highly artificial zero interest rate right now. If Janet Yellen pumps it up to 0.5%, the economy is not going to come to some kind of a screeching halt. We're just going to have some semblance of normality or move towards some semblance of normality in interest rates. It's not necessarily going to be a bad thing.
But wait,
hold on.
You clearly, Felix, have not been paying attention, right? Because what we have gotten used to in this economy is the not normal. We are used to this. And what happens when Janet comes out and says, okay, it's a 0.5% now, people are going to go bananas.
Oh, my God, I can't wait.
They are.
Well, it's going to be fun to watch.
They are going to keep on employing people. They are going to keep on hiring people. They are going to keep on giving pay raises or not giving pay raises. It's going to look exactly the same as it does right now. There will be no visible difference.
Wow, you're being extremely rational.
This is an incredibly bold call.
Yeah,
I mean,
I think so too.
The markets might care, but the real economy won't blink.
Okay. Right. Well, I'll side with you on that point. I think there are a lot of money managers who will see that 0.25 increase and go, ah!
But then we get back to the markets. All right. Let's move on for a second. We're going to stay with Janet Yellen, actually. And this thing that we said, it's sort of related. You know, I came out earlier this week and we had this conversation in our morning meeting the other day before the Fed came out with its announcement. And we talked about how Janet was completely data dependent and she doesn't really care about some of the consumer confidence, consumer sentiment numbers, and also, you know, the market. Does Janet Yellen care about the individual person here, Lynette, or is she totally going to go on data?
Why should she care what we think? We have been wrong about this economy as individuals so many times. We created a housing bubble. We're always creating bubbles. We're always buying crappy stocks. We just have no idea what we're talking about. So right. Why should she? We need the numbers.
All right. Feel
Janet,
and the numbers
Janet,
which matter.
Do your thing, girl. All do right. your
All
thing,
right.
girl.
The numbers which matter are not the stock market. It's not even the bond market. It's the employment numbers, which she gets in great detail every month. That's what she's going to go on.
All right. Change of subject. Felix, we have half a minute to do this in. You get the whack at it. I want to talk about corporate profits, specifically tech, Facebook, Twitter, Yelp. They're making money, but not as much as everybody on Wall Street seems to want them to be making. Are you troubled?
Not in the slightest. I mean, Twitter's making loads of money.
Yeah,
Wall Street just wants user growth. They don't care about the profitability, it seems. Facebook stock is going through the roof because people trust Mark Zuckerberg to make money in the long term. I think Wall Street's quite happy.
All right. Fair
no,
enough.
Wall Street loves no. being miserable and they're enjoying their misery right
maybe
now.
Maybe that's just you too. Lynette Lopez at Business Insider, Felix Salmon at Fusion. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Bye, Kai.
Have a good weekend. Wall Street today was, in keeping with the theme of the first 4 minutes of this broadcast, thoroughly meh. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Lawmakers over in Europe are gearing up for the big event in their yearly calendars. Their long summer break is nearly upon them. Before they go, though, there is some work to be done. The Greek debt crisis isn't just going to fix itself. You know, in Athens today, government ministers met with their international creditors to start hammering out the actual details of the bailout package that was announced in principle when we were over there a couple of weeks ago. Another round of austerity measures has a lot of Greeks disillusioned with the euro, the single currency. Funnily enough, a lot of people in Germany, the most influential of Greeks' creditors, are disillusioned too. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that story.
Left-wing protesters outside the German parliament have adopted a handy new slogan to chant the two-syllable Greek word for no, ochi. That's no to the austerity that Germany continues to impose on Greece. But inside the parliament, more than 100 conservative lawmakers were saying a different kind of no. No to the third Greek bailout. Klaus-Peter Vilsch voted no, even though it might mean Greece would default on some 80 billion euros worth of German loans.
For me, I think that the money is lost anyway. And the sooner you stop throwing more money in a barrel without a bottom, you stop losing more money.
Nevertheless, the lawmakers voted to back the move towards bailout number three. Chancellor Angela Merkel said there'd be chaos in the eurozone if they didn't. But out on the streets of Berlin, many people are clearly unhappy about pouring more money into Greece. The whole thing is very annoying, says 52-year-old cook Uwe Grunebast. A few billion more and then again more billions. And where's all the money coming from? German taxpayers. And we don't get anything from it. And 30-year-old software engineer Nico Rolle now thinks the euro's been a disaster.
I think the euro is bad for every country. For when you look at Italy or France or Spain, they're all suffering because of the euro. And I don't think it was a good thing, the euro.
Hardly anyone is calling for Germany to pull out of the euro. The losses the country would suffer in loans and other cross-border liabilities runs into the trillions. But many Germans would like to see one or two other countries leave. The fact that the finance minister, Wolfgang Schäuble, called for Grexit is significant, says Christian Schmidt, a Eurosceptic entrepreneur.
I think Schäuble deep down believes that indeed it would be the best if Greece were to leave and that we would all be better off.
Schmidt would like to see a leaner currency union without the likes of fiscally irresponsible Greece, and he thinks that's what we'll get when Greece asks Germany for another bailout in 3 years' time.
I believe this is the last bailout we will see, as the number of parliamentarians will increase who will no longer support it.
4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
At its launch 15 years ago, the euro was greeted with wild enthusiasm in some member states. That ardour has now cooled. For some member states, the downside of living within the straitjacket of a German-dominated currency union is now painfully apparent. And so is the downside for Germany. The euro is still intact, but, asks Michael Wolgemuth of the Open Europe think tank in Berlin, for how much longer?
The real question to me is, will the eurozone survive the next recession, which may come in 1 or 2 years? And this could then be the beginning of the end.
At the European Desk in London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up.
So we're paying workers extra money, really, to help them with their low pay.
The downsides of government work. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 56 points on this Friday, about a 3rd percent, 17,689. The NASDAQ dipped about a 0.5 point. We'll call that flat, 5128, pretty much where it was yesterday. The S&P 500 down 4 points, 0.2 percent, 2103. For the week gone by, the Dow off 2.9%, the NASDAQ off 2.3%, the S&P 500 off 2.2%. Oil companies trickled lower because of the big drop in oil prices over the past year or so, and thus falling profits for them. ExxonMobil bore down 4.5%. Chevron slipped almost 4.9% today. Coca-Cola Enterprises, a big independent bottler for the U.S. beverage behemoth, fizzled up 12.4% today. Bond prices rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.18%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction spending for June. It also releases personal income and spending data for that month. August is National Peach Month. Yes, July is just about over. And what to do with all those peaches? Certainly Martha Stewart has some tips. She turned 74. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Get your plane tickets now, everybody. Beijing is going to host the 2022 Winter Olympics. The announcement was made this morning. It's going to be the city's second Games in a span of 14 years after the 2008 Summer Olympics. But 14 years is a very long time in economic terms. Marketplace's Rob Schmitz is actually in the studio with me today. He is our China correspondent, of course. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Kai.
So let's talk about a couple of things about this. First of all, these games come at a very different economic point in China's life than did the 2008 games.
Yeah. I mean, when the 2008 games were announced in China in 2001, yeah, the streets of Beijing were full of people all night. They were partying like it was they had just won a war. And I think I've seen images from the streets of Beijing been announced today. And it's a little more subdued. They've already had one of these. And China was a very different country. In 2001, things were looking up. The economy was going crazy. It was going almost at double-digit speed. And in the years leading up to 2008, we had 10 to 14% GDP growth.
Wow.
That's not the case anymore. We've got 5 to 7% GDP growth, and things are slowing down.
Slowing down. Well, that's the second point. These games aren't going to come for another, help me do the math here, like six-something years, 7 years.
7 years.
Hazard the guess for me. How's it going to go between now and then?
I think it's going to be a difficult road for China, because here we go. You know, China's trying to change the way that its economy is run.
Right.
They're trying to turn from an infrastructure-led economy to a consumer growth-led economy. And here we have a huge, huge infrastructure project. We're going to host the 2022 Winter Olympics. This is going to cost not only the $4 billion that China is saying it's going to cost, but it's also going to cost an estimated $50 billion more to basically create the infrastructure around the ski town, to create the high-speed rail, the roads, what have you. This is the old model of growth. This is not the direction that China wants to go with its economy, on paper at least, but right. It seems like they're reverting to this again.
One of the things we talked about in our morning meeting this morning when we were hashing this over was the pollution effect, right? Yeah,
right?
I mean, it was a big deal for the Beijing Games. They took care of it kind of by shutting down factories and limiting cars in downtown and businesses and all that stuff. They're going to have to do the same thing again?
I think that's a big question. I think that they obviously will do that regardless of where they're at in trying to cut pollution. But I think it's important to point out that Beijing has made some significant efforts, some significant movement on the pollution issue. The problem is, though, you've got 300 million people that live in northern right. China, and these folks are becoming consumers. They're consuming. They're buying cars. And so, you know, realistically, there's going to be a lot of pollution for, you know, years to come, for decades to come. I think what we'll probably see is a repeat of the 2008 Olympics, where they flipped the switch, said, you know, basically had all these
shut
restrictions on factories, and then they'll turn it back on again when it's over.
Rob Schmitz, our Shanghai correspondent, he is back from book leave. As you can tell, you're back on the ground in Shanghai when?
On the ground in Shanghai in a week and a half.
All right. Thanks a lot, Rob.
Thanks a lot, Kai.
One of the things we're probably going to start hearing more about as the presidential campaign really gets going is the size of the federal workforce, as in, usually, that it's too big. Truth is, the number of people actually employed by the government has been falling for years. Most of those people have been replaced, though, by contractors on the theory that they are cheaper, and they can be. But things don't always work out well for the workers or for the government, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
Groups of federal contract workers have been walking off the job and holding protests every few months. It's part of a campaign called Good Jobs Nation, backed by organized labor. They're pushing for a $15 an hour minimum wage for federal contract workers and union representation. The most recent demonstration was in Washington in late July. Santia Bailey is one of the government contract workers speaking out at the rallies. She's a cashier in a Senate cafeteria working for a contractor hired by the government, which pays her $10.59 an hour. I met her recently at a park down the hill from the Capitol.
I worked at the Capitol for 2 years and 7 months.
Bailey says her Capitol paycheck didn't cover all of her bills. So 2 years ago, she got a second job at Kentucky Fried Chicken. She says she had a miscarriage recently because she was working so much.
I do probably like 40 hours plus at the Capitol and then 30 plus hours at KFC. So I really didn't have time to rest because I never had a day off.
The government started replacing full-time federal workers with contract employees back in the 80s under the Reagan administration. The idea had bipartisan support over the years and was part of initiatives to control government spending. Supporters of privatization say it does save the government money. Among them, Adrian Moore, vice president of the free market Reason Foundation. He says contractors are more efficient than the federal government.
Contractors don't use as many workers to do the same work. They run with leaner workforces.
But Moore also says contracting has to be done well to save money. Contractors have to be supervised. Jeffrey Myron is an economist at Harvard and the Libertarian Cato Institute. He says supervision is needed from the moment contractors submit bids to the federal government.
The bidding process can be somewhat messy and complicated. It can sometimes be rigged. It can sometimes be manipulated. And so it's not a completely fail-safe approach.
That's led to a backlash against privatization and assertions that it doesn't save the government money from people like Tara Young. She's an organizer with Good Jobs Nation. I met Young in the park with the Senate cashier, Santia Bailey. Young says the contractor employees make so little, they end up on government programs for the poor. Bailey is on Medicaid.
Workers are on Section 8. They use food stamps. So we're paying workers extra money, really, to help them with their low pay.
Young says taxpayers get hit up twice, once to pay for the contract workers' salaries and again to pay for government programs they need to get by. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Today in stock market news, bicycles. All right, technically not bicycles, but the bicycle-based exercise known as spinning. SoulCycle, the boutique spinning studio, has filed to go public. It has been doing well of late, especially with the celebrity set. Marketplace's Gigi Duban reports.
Here's a riddle for you. What do Chelsea Clinton, Lady Gaga, and Kelly Ripa have in common? They all love SoulCycle. Notice, this company barely advertises. It doesn't have to.
They've done a great job of branding themselves, of marketing themselves.
Jim Thomas is with Fitness Management and Consulting. He says one of the biggest challenges facing fitness studios is that they eventually fade into obscurity. He says that's not likely to happen with SoulCycle anytime soon. Just ask Ryan Michael Shaw, a former dancer in New York City. Two or three times a week, Shaw elbows his way past people to make sure he gets into a class. 45 minutes later,
I leave those classes and I feel amazing.
Shaw says when the music and the energy are right, class is like a religious experience, an expensive religious experience.
Oh, I drink the juice. Let's be clear. I walk out and buy the $80 Lululemon SoulCycle tank top.
The question is, how much longer will people drink the juice? John Atwood is managing director of the Atwood Consulting Group.
This kind of enthusiasm is very hard to maintain with the American public, and especially the city American public.
Big cities are where SoulCycle does best. 95% of its revenues come from New York, Los Angeles, and San Francisco.
Then the question is, what about Peoria, Illinois, you know, and all these other towns?
Atwood says people there might be wowed, but that doesn't mean they'll shell out $32 a class. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Relativity Media has filed for bankruptcy. The film studio is said to have piled up more than $1 billion in debt, only about half that amount in assets, and so is using Chapter 11 to pay off its creditors, including some A-list actors, producers, and, oh, by the way, lenders as well, and then regroup under the protection of bankruptcy. Wait, what's that? You say you've never heard of Relativity? Yeah, that's kind of part of the problem, as Marketplace's Nova Sappho reports.
Relativity founder Ryan Kavanaugh wanted nothing less than to change the way Hollywood does business.
If you think about today's blockbuster model, it requires that successful films appeal to a very broad audience.
That's Kavanaugh speaking at an industry event in 2013. His plan was to make smaller films, appealing to a narrow segment of the movie-going public, then make more money from other deals like TV shows based on the movies or streaming rights. John Sloss is an entertainment industry lawyer.
Absent any significant hits, it's hard to maintain this kind of enterprise for a long period of time.
And significant hits have been mostly absent. Movies like The Social Network about Facebook and The Fighter, they did well. But others like last year's 3 Days to Kill starring Kevin Costner barely broke even. With the bankruptcy filing, a group of Relativity's big lenders are trying to buy the firm, and other movie studios are looking for bargains.
There are projects in development and projects that are completed but haven't been released yet. And some of those may be worth something.
Jonathan Handel is an entertainment industry lawyer. He says most of Relativity's assets are complicated, like its film library.
You've got the question of, you know, picking apart these assets one by one.
And among the studio's creditors, who'll get paid off first? Actors like Bradley Cooper, who starred in Limitless, are expecting residual checks. Director Brett Ratner says he's owed fees for a TV show Relativity produced. The pecking order will depend on which payments are considered most important to the company's future. In Los Angeles, I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
I'm Sitara Nieves. I'm the senior producer of this program, and I'm here with
Deborah Clark,
the executive producer and vice president of Marketplace. And we are lying here in ambush for Kai Ryssdal, because tomorrow is his 10-year anniversary of hosting the show.
Am I supposed to be in there?
Come on in.
Please enter.
You guys know you're in my office.
Come on in.
Right?
We have a pop quiz.
I don't know how good an idea that is.
We have a pop quiz.
Okay, go ahead. Let's go.
Go.
10 years ago.
Yes.
When you were yet a new host on Marketplace.
Yes.
What was the lead story 10 years ago?
Oh, I know this. It was like oil something.
Oh,
and it was
God.
Oil at like 60-something dollars a barrel,
oh,
which is pretty close to
my
today.
God. Could you play that?
Mind Like a Steel Trap. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thank you for being here on this August the 1st.
This is my worst nightmare.
And congratulations. We set a record today, although not one most of us would be too happy about. The price of a barrel of oil hit $62.30 in New York this afternoon.
That is crazy. Dumb. Okay, here's the next one.
I have one.
Wow. I have one. What Numbers music did we play?
Happy, sad, man. So this was 2005. It was happy. But first, let's do the numbers. What is that?
I know.
Well, we took that one out of the rotation.
The worst smooth, cool jazz.
Oh my
horrible.
That was terrible.
What were you all thinking back then?
I don't know. It wasn't me.
Okay, finally, we're going to end on, you made a personal admission on that broadcast 10 years ago.
I do too many of those.
Yeah. So what was that one?
What are you kidding? I'd like make personal admissions on this show like three times a week.
You remember oil prices, but you don't remember personal admission?
Well, what does that tell you about me? But that's a whole different thing. I stepped on the scale this morning, as I do pretty much every Monday, and it seems I am among the half of all American workers who've gained weight since they started their current jobs.
Well, okay.
Have I gained a couple?
So here's the thing.
Oh,
you didn't actually tell us what you weighed. But I am curious.
I bet I'm within five pounds of whatever it was.
Oh, please.
Oh, come on.
We can't actually verify
this. This is radio, not television. Nobody can
see. Happy anniversary.
Happy anniversary.
Host.
Thank you. I think I hate you both. Ten years, man. I'll tell you what, it has gone by like that. All right. It's Friday. We're out of here. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Sitar Nieves, as you just heard, is the senior producer of this program. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have a great weekend, everybody. See you Monday. This is APM.